Alrighty. Should we start?
Ja. Nee, erstmal jetzt ein Screenshot.
Achso, hoppala, danke.
Dann starten wir.
Okay, dann bist du ready?
Ja.
3, 2, 1.
Hä? Did you get that?
I'm so confused. Also ich verstehe nur Bahnhof.
You only understand train station? It's all Greek to me.
Understanding train station. Living between cultures with Josh and Phelan.
Welcome back to another episode, everyone. Glad to be back here with you guys. We haven't done this in a while, but if you guys don't know who I am, my name is Josh, and I'm here with the wonderful...
Feli! Thank you for that very nice introduction. Yeah, we actually skipped an episode for those of you who usually just listen on the audio streaming platforms. I don't know if you guys saw it, because I tried to post on Instagram, YouTube community tab, etc. But, you know, if people just kind of open up their podcast stream or feed every week and it just doesn't pop up, then there's no real way for us to communicate with you guys.
Yeah, it's tricky. That's a better reason if you guys do have Instagram to follow us there. That way you can get the information there or just look on YouTube as well.
Yeah.
We try to post all of that sort of information when we have it on, at least on those two sites.
Yeah, but we're back now. I guess our rhythm now has changed because instead of skipping 2 weeks, we skipped 1 week. So I guess now we're always on that other week.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. Maybe since, and you're going to talk about this, I know, but since you'll be here in Munich here in a bit, we'll be able to hopefully get caught up on some and maybe...
We could also add an extra episode in between or something like that and then get back on the regular schedule. We'll figure it out anyways. We're back now. And yeah, as you just said, Josh, I am about to get ready to pack my stuff and come home to Munich this week. Actually the day that this episode is being released. So like when you guys are listening, if you do listen right when it gets released, then I'll probably already be on the plane on my way to Munich and I'm getting there on Friday the 17th. And then kind of one of the reasons why I'm coming home now is that it's going to be Carnival, Fasching, as we say in Bavaria. There's so many different terms. There's Karneval. That's what, you know, the real... Carnival culture say in Germany, because like Cologne, Düsseldorf, Mainz, like in kind of Western Germany, that's where the Carnival Hochburgen are, the carnival main hotspots.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm sure we have a, what do we say in English? I don't know. I know we have a similar
I'm just going to call it a hotspot.
Yeah, hotspot.
Yeah, so these people say Carnival.
Bastion. I think bastion is what we say.
That's a good word. The Carnival bastions of Germany are in Cologne, Düsseldorf, Mainz, etc. And I already know I've probably forgotten a bunch and they're going to hate me because there's a big rivalry going on about Carnival too in Germany. But then in Bavaria, we call it Fasching. And in Baden-Württemberg, I think, or I don't know exactly where the borders are, but some people call it Fastnacht. And there's many, many other words for it, actually. But it's all basically the same thing. It's an old tradition that, you know, happens all around the world, but every country kind of does it differently. Not every country celebrates it, of course, but there's Brazilian Carnival. There's Venetian Carnival in Venice. And in Germany, it's, you know, it has a bunch of interesting traditions with, like, meetings is what they're called, like Sitzungen and like these carnival organizations that have like this really interesting hierarchy.
It's so weird to me.
It's very old fashioned, but the main thing for people is just getting dressed up. It's basically our version of Halloween in that sense. We just dress up as anything. There is no rule really. It doesn't have to be scary. It can be funny, goofy, pretty.
There are lots of onesies.
Yeah, there's one because it's kind of the winter. So that's like the one thing. If you go to carnival parties that are outside, which is a big thing, street carnivals, and you kind of have to make sure that you stay warm. But there's also carnival parties inside, just like regular parties. But yeah, that's kind of one of the occasions why I thought, you know what, I haven't been home for carnival in quite a while. Some of my friends are going to have some time off too, because, you know, some people take vacation days, and then there's Rosenmontag and Faschingsdienstag. Fat Tuesday in English.
Mardi Gras,
That a lot of people take off. And I mean, in the Cologne area, I think they're all just off automatically. People are
It's also with Carnival that they like cut the ties, cut people's ties. Is that right?
That's like a... That's like a Weiberfasching or Weiberfastnacht. That's the Thursday where that starts. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I don't know. There, all of that is so German to me. It's like a very weird tradition. Like, because in the U.S. you have Mardi Gras, which is celebrated in New Orleans, and people throughout the country also have little parties for it sometimes. But that's not like a, that wasn't a huge part of the culture that I grew up with. Mm. So like when I see everything going on with Karneval, I definitely am like, okay, this is German. This is very German. And I was in I was at Marienplatz, so downtown Munich yesterday. And was surprised that there was like a random parade going on through Marienplatz with like tractors pulling various floats with people dancing and singing and lots of Schlager. it was very funny. It was very funny. So I can understand why you would want to come for that.
As a kid, I always loved it because there are a lot of these parades. And one of the things like for kids is that, first of all, you get to dress up for kindergarten and school. And then you get to go to like Fasching parties with your friends. And, you know, there's usually lots of activities. Like I remember Fasching parties that like at our church, for example. I didn't go to church, but they had like a community area where they always hosted something for the whole neighborhood. And then it was just a bunch of different games, like little party games like Eierlauf. I don't know what any of those would be in English.
An egg roll? Or is it like on a, like do on a you spoon. Actually, oh, on a spoon? Yeah, I forget what we call it, to be honest.
But, or a Zeitungstanz, newspaper dance, where you have to dance with a partner, like your friend or your sibling or whoever, and then they stop the music and you have to freeze, and then you have to fold the paper and make it smaller and you can't step outside of it. Like, you know,
games like that. Okay, I don't know that one. That's funny.
That was always a lot of fun. And then the other part of it was that when you go to the parades, they usually throw candy to the kids. And that was always the big thing. I mean, I guess there's kind of a connection.
Equivalent.
Yeah, kind of, yeah, an equivalent to Halloween with the candy too. It's not like the goal of Fasching that you collect a bunch of candy, but it was definitely a thing that when you went to these parades, some of these were specifically kind of targeted towards kids, then all the kids were just standing on the sidelines and trying to catch as much candy as they could and pick it up from the ground and have like some kind of bag with them where they would throw it into. So
that's how that's how the parade was, and I got pelted with a couple pieces of candy because I wasn't expecting it.
Oh boy.
Another thing I was going to add too about Karneval is the jelly donuts. And like so our friend Niklas, who we've interviewed a couple times on this podcast as well, was actually here in Munich, and he was telling me a story about how he had already had a Berliner. And I was very confused for a second. I wasn't confused, but it just took me a second, like, wait, I haven't heard anyone refer to it as a Berliner in who knows how long. Because it's one of those words, as you know, obviously, Feli, but for our listener, depending on where you are in Germany, people refer to this one jelly donut many different ways. And it's very confusing sometimes because the word that you might use is different than someone else. And what they use is actually something different in what you're used to hearing. So like, for example, in Bavaria, we call them Krapfen. In Northern Germany, they tend to call them Berliner. Or in, I think most parts of Germany, they call them Berliner. But in Berlin, they call them a Pfannkuchen. But a Pfannkuchen to someone else is a pancake, so it gets very confusing. But I just thought I'd mention that because that was weird to hear someone refer to it as a Berliner.
I still don't know, what do Berliner people call an actual pancake?
That's actually a really good question.
That's I don't know if I've ever had that answer, and I just forgot about it. Okay, if you guys know, I'm sure a lot of you guys know, because we have a lot of German listeners.
Yeah.
So if you're from Berlin or you just know the answer, send us a DM on Instagram or comment on the YouTube video, because that's just like, that doesn't make any sense.
No, it's very confusing.
Because then you need another term for the actual pancake.
Is it an Eierkuchen then? Is
maybe,
that what they call it?
Maybe. Yeah, that's just a synonym for pancake,
like
maybe.
Yeah, like an egg cake instead of a pancake. Maybe that's what they call it.
That
I don't know. That
be
would
it.
Be the, that's the only thing I can think of. But
yeah.
It's a lot of carnival talk, which we weren't planning on.
Yeah, but no, I want to add one more last thing. Mm-hmm. I actually made a video about Fasching and carnival, I want to say 3 years ago, maybe at this point, a while ago. I'm going to link it somewhere. So if you want to watch that, I kind of summarized all the things you need to know about German carnival. But one of the things that really stands out specifically with carnival is this thing about all the different names for everything. And it's not just the pastry, the Krapfen, and the name for the actual celebration. It's also the chants, like Alaf,
Alaf,
It's like every village basically has its own little chant for it and its own traditions. And it's, Fasching is a crazy, crazy holiday that with so many regional differences. So it's going to be different, I think, wherever you go in Germany.
And maybe you talked about this in your video, I'm not sure, Feli, but I've been hearing more and more people say, like, some of the origins of how Carnaval came to be are quite questionable. So, like, it would be interesting. This is completely conjecture from what I've heard from Germans. Like, these may be myths, probably are myths. But, like, someone was telling me that, because I thought it just was, like, you're about to lead up to Lent, so people are trying to have fun and enjoy before they start fasting for the Lent season. Until Easter, I think, is when Lent ends.
Yeah.
But another theory, I guess, is that the gene pool in that area was very, very isolated in the various villages. So they threw these big parties to bring people together to help with the gene pool.
I don't think I mentioned that in my video. I'm pretty sure I did a bunch of research back then.
Okay.
At least I don't remember mentioning it in my video. Who knows? Maybe I did.
Yeah.
But no, that doesn't really ring a bell.
Like I said, it just is a random myth that a German told me. So I'm putting that out there. And yeah. You guys should tell us if that's true or not.
I definitely do think, again, I don't remember all the details that I researched for that video, so this might not be as accurate anymore. But I'm pretty sure that it was one of those things where, like, it had pagan backgrounds and just, like, cultural backgrounds where, like, people would dress up for a certain period of time to scare away the ghosts or spirits, whatever, or had certain reasons to dress up. And then at some point, it somehow got connected with church, a.k.a. Yeah. You celebrate right before you start fasting for Lent. And that's usually, like, for a lot of these traditions, at least in Europe and Germany specifically, those were all mixed up at one point in time, where then suddenly two things were connected that actually didn't have any connection before that whatsoever. And then suddenly it was, like, kind of connected in time so that this would always. So now, like, Fasching, just like Easter, always takes place at a different time because it always, I don't actually know what it's connected to, but I guess Easter is connected to, like, the moon or something like that. But
I don't know. It's just the church calendar. I don't know how they.
Yeah. And so Fasching also then is connected to the church calendar. So sometimes it's in January still, but most of the time it's in February. I think there has even been times where it was in early March.
I have no clue.
So, yeah. But it's usually when it's cold in Germany, which, like, if you celebrate Carnival in Brazil, awesome. You can go, like, half naked as they do. In Germany, you usually have to make sure that you stay warm in your costume.
But I also feel like it's the time of year that people are getting excited for, maybe, like, spring to finally come. And I think people are excited to be outside. That's why a lot of the activities are still outside, even though it's cold. I don't know. That just seems to be my impression.
Yeah, I've definitely also celebrated it in snow.
How horrible. Yeah.
No, I'm excited, though. I'm probably going to go downtown to the pedestrian area on Fat Tuesday on Faschingsdienstag, because that's usually the whole area. Like, on Rosenmontag and Faschingsdienstag, the whole area is usually closed off. There's lots of stages, and you can just, I mean, obviously you can always drink in public, but people just kind of drink in public and day drink.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, I have plans with a friend.
I haven't experienced that before because of Corona.
Yeah.
And COVID.
Did
and
they
everything.
Have any Fasching celebrations last year?
I don't think so. I would be very surprised because we didn't have any Christmas markets. So if they weren't allowing Christmas markets, I don't see why they would allow that.
Yeah.
And I don't recall any, like, seeing anything that made me think of Fasching.
Yeah. So I think that was still the time last year when they had extended those measures.
Yeah.
More and more, and then I think Easter was maybe about the time when it was finally lifted slowly. So yeah, that's gonna be exciting. But okay, enough with Fasching. Well, another big holiday that happened in the US yesterday was the Super Bowl. It's not an actual holiday, of course, but it's a cultural holiday.
did you follow it at all? So yeah, that was the thing. I met up with some friends here who I know from Cincinnati for dinner last night, and we were like, are you guys going to watch the Super Bowl? Most people had to work, so it was like, no, I don't really think we're going to. And then we, for a quick second, said, yes, we would. So then we came back to my place, and we were hanging out and had a beer or two, and then we were all tired and just went home and slept. But the thing is, it starts so late here.
Yeah.
Like, it starts at 12:30 a.m. if you want to watch it. So that's just really, really late. We were sitting in my family room at like 10:30, and we're like, guys, we still have 2 hours before it even begins.
Yeah. It's a big commitment. So, yeah. A lot of Germans do it, though, which is crazy. Like, more and more people do that. And I've done it a couple times before I ever even went to the U.S. And I still don't even care about football.
Yeah.
But and I didn't care about football back then, but it was just kind of like this thing where like friends would be like, hey, we're having a Super Bowl party this year, and then you kind of go over to your friend's place already kind of late at night, and then you stay up until 12, obviously, and then you stay up until 4 or 5 a.m., however long the game takes. And it's like just a very special party, if you will. And then people really like to make American-themed snacks and food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think if Cincinnati were playing again, which they were really close this year, I definitely would have stayed up and watched it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't worth it to me.
Yeah.
And I could see the halftime show on YouTube afterwards, so it was all good.
Yeah. That's all I watched, actually, because I wasn't feeling well yesterday. I was supposed to go watch the Super Bowl with Ben and his family, but yeah, ended up not feeling too good, and I'm still not feeling so well right now. So fingers crossed that I'll be fine for the time that I'm supposed to fly home. But I just stayed in bed, and then I didn't watch the game. I only tuned in for the halftime show. That was all I really heard about. And like last year, as you said, when the Cincinnati Bengals were in the Super Bowl, I cared a little bit more, of course, because it's just like this local connection. And you can just see everyone being so invested into it. But this time, I feel like most people here didn't really have a huge emotional connection to any of the teams.
Yeah. I mean, that's how it normally is, because Cincinnati doesn't make it to the Super Bowl very often. So I think last year was definitely Ausnahme, an exception to the rule.
For sure. Sometimes there's like a team, though, that everyone just hates. I think most people hated the Chiefs a little bit because I think they beat the Bengals.
They're the they're the ones who kept us from going.
Yeah. So I think that was kind of a thing, but they're not like a main rival, I don't think.
No.
Anyways, we both know nothing about football, so just wanted to mention that it happened, and obviously it was a big deal in the U.S. And the rest of the world.
Well, I think with all of this talk of like cultural exchanges and figuring out different things that are going on at different times of year, and like we were saying too with Carnival, the different sayings that you need to know when you're going to celebrate, our sponsor this week is definitely a great thing for you to check out to get some of that knowledge on language and exploring other cultures as well and getting that exposure. It's also February, the month of love. So if you guys are interested in maybe making some new human connections as well, bless you, Feli.
Thank you.
Should I keep going?
You can. Okay. We can keep it in.
If you guys are interested in making some more human connections as well during this very special month of the year, then Lingoda is a great place for you.
You obviously all know Lingoda already. It's an online language school, and they offer this really cool challenge that's called the Sprint Challenge, where you'll really be able to boost your language skills to the next level within just 2 months, so 60 days, and you can even get your money back. As you guys know, if you do the Super Sprint, which means that you would do 30 classes a month for 2 months, and you follow all the rules, then you can get 100% cash back, aka 100% of your money back, if you follow all the requirements and don't skip a class. Or you could also do the regular sprint, where it's 15 classes a month for 2 months, and then you get 50% cash back if you follow through with all of that. So that's always just a really, really good motivation. And of course, depending on which language you pick, they have German, of course, they have French, they have Spanish, they have English and business English. You can learn all the words that you need for everyday life, such as Krapfen, for example. They also always have topic-related lessons that you can pick from. Or for the month of love, you can learn things like Ich liebe dich, Je t'aime, Te amo, what else? You can probably say I love you in a lot more languages, can't you?
Yeah, I can. I won't start listing them now, though.
How would you say it in business English?
Well, that's a good question.
I really appreciate your kind response.
Your warm correspondence has been very well received.
So, you know, that's all you can learn at Lingoda. And of course, with our discount code, you can even save more money. It's UTS2023 for this month, UTS2023. And with that, you can save 20 euros, which equals 25 US dollars off the deposit that you have to pay when you sign up.
Another great thing about Lingoda is how flexible they are. They have classes that are offered 24/7. So you really can find classes during the times that work for you. You can design your own course for yourself too, like Feli was saying. And you're also always learning from certified professional language teachers that are native level, and you will really be able to learn the way that people speak, not just the way that you normally learn in class.
Yeah, and they also always include cultural things too, besides the just the language part. You'll also learn about culture too, like in this class, for example, that I attended recently, where this girl from Venezuela talked about punctuality.
Aber wir haben gar nicht keine Pünktlichkeit. Es ist tut mir so, so leid. Das war wirklich schwer für mich.
Ja, also ganz anders als hier.
Ja.
So if you want to check it out, you can find the link to sign up in the info box or the show notes for the podcast. And of course, the discount code is UTS2023 to save 20 euros, which is $25.
Now, jumping into this week's topic, it kind of goes along the same vein of culture and language and things that can be confusing. Mm-hmm. We thought that we would share kind of our visa experiences with you all. And tell you kind of what our processes were, what were some of the struggles that we had, and some of our stories along the way. I think everyone, if you don't leave your country, or if you stay within the EU, if you're an EU citizen, you don't really get confronted by visas too often, but it can be something that's really confusing and something that can be really frustrating and requires a lot of patience. We are by no means experts on this topic, as we're not immigration lawyers for Germany or the US, but we just thought it would be fun to share with you our experiences, what we learned along the way, and maybe you can learn something from it or be inspired to try something new and seek a visa yourself.
Yeah, and also maybe realize that even though those things can be very, very challenging or can seem very challenging and off-putting because it's just like a long list of requirements and bureaucratic steps that you have to take, it's possible to do it because we've both gone through a lot of those processes. Yes. And if you just take it step by step, it's really not all that bad. It's also really funny because I think this episode has been a long time coming because I think we mentioned this in one of our very first episodes that we wanted to talk about this topic. Here we are, like
right
2.5 years later.
I was going to say right on time.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I mean, you've already shared a little bit of your visa experiences when you first moved to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we also did mention that I had an interesting experience with an overstay. So I'm going to be finally telling that story today.
Yes.
But yeah, I think it would probably be best if you start because I think you're currently going through it and your stories are a little bit more current.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, well, I guess kind of if I look back on my experiences with visas or coming to Germany, it all started back when I was doing my internships during my studies. I never needed a visa because as an American, you can stay in Germany for 90 days without needing a visa, even for business purposes. So I was doing a lot of back and forth travel between the two countries. The 90-day stay that you can have applies to a 180-day period. So like mm-hmm. if you stay in Germany for 90 days, then there have to be a whole another 90 days of you outside of Germany before you can come back for another 90 days, technically. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how it started for me. And I think that's something that we as Americans are very privileged by at this point. That at this point, when you come to Europe, you don't even have to fill out anything. You just show up and you're allowed to enter. I think that will be changing here soon. But that is the current Stand der Dinge. That's the current
status.
Yeah, that's the status quo at the moment. But then when I decided to move to Germany, things got a little bit more complicated. Mm-hmm. And I had to start the visa process. And when I first moved to Germany, I applied for the blue card. The blue card is an accelerated path to permanent residency for what the German government calls Fachkräfte. So mm-hmm. what would we call that in English, Feli?
Skilled workers?
Yeah, skilled workers. So for a requirement for a blue card is that you have to have a college degree that's recognized by Germany, and you have to either have a job offer or already a job contract. And then you have to submit all of your documentation. And in my case, I wanted to start working as soon as I arrived in Germany. So what you can do is you can use that 90-day period as an American that you get just to arrive in Germany and get everything set up. You can even use that 90 days to find a job and talk to people and then officially apply for your what they call Aufenthaltstitel, which is like your visa basically here in Germany while you're in country. But since I wanted to start working kind of right away as of day one, I had to make an appointment at the consulate in the US and actually get a visa in my passport. Because the actual card that you get that is your visa or your residence permit, you can only apply for it in Germany. and like I said, I'm talking from an American's perspective and my experience. So I don't know if that's true for all countries, but that's definitely the case for Americans. So before applying for the actual visa, so I sent all my documentation to the consulate in Chicago. But before doing so, I had to get my degree recognized by the German government, basically. You can either get like a equivalent saying it's like the exact same thing, or you can get, it's like a Zeugnisbewertung, where they just look to say, okay, this we agree that this is a good degree or something that we're happy to recognize. It's mm-hmm. kind of a step down from the actual Anerkennung is what it's called, so the recognition.
Okay, so the one is called Anerkennung, mm-hmm. the other one is called Bewertung.
Yeah.
Okay, so like recognition and
evaluation,
yeah. Okay.
It's very confusing. There's a database that if you're interested in seeing if your degree is recognized, it's called the ANABIN, ANABIN database is something that we can link in this video or in the show notes as well. But you have to have both your university, which is recognized, and the degree that you have. In my case, for example, the University of Cincinnati was in the system. So if anyone has applied for their degree to be recognized in the past, it will show up in the database. So if someone from your university has already gone through the process, your university will already be in the database. And if they studied the same thing as you or have the same degree as you, your degree will most likely also be in the database. Like I said, in my case, the university was in the database, but my degree wasn't. So I had to submit the documentation, send it to Germany. I had to send one of the things actually via like post, like mail. Because it had to have a wet signature on it. Very, very German.
That's what that's called? A wet signature?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Like a wet real signature. Something.
Yeah, like a real signature, like mm-hmm. actually with a pen, nothing scanned. Mm-hmm. So I sent my documentation, I think it was in Köln. So like they needed a copy of my diploma, of my transcripts, all of that. And then they did their evaluation and then sent me the certificate of the Zeugnisbewertung. Mm-hmm. And then once I had all of my documentation, I submitted it to the consulate in Chicago and got an appointment in the consulate, which was really weird for me. That was my first time ever being in a consulate, mm-hmm. ever, because I never traveled anywhere outside of the U.S. that I needed to go to a consulate prior to that. It was just a really weird experience for me because I drove, the 4.5 hours from Cincinnati to Chicago just for that, which is also just kind of a weird experience. It was all very weird, something that is very out of the norm for a lot of Americans. I think for maybe some Europeans, it's something a little bit more common that you are exposed to more. It could also just be my bubble that I'm in, that I have a lot of people that travel a lot.
Yeah. I never had to get a visa except for when I went to Thailand, and I'm pretty sure I didn't have to interview anywhere, which I don't remember. How do you get a visa for Thailand? But I did have a visa and I don't remember going anywhere for an appointment.
Which would also make sense, though, because the German passport is one of the strongest passports out there. It's technically stronger than the American passport, or not only technically, it is, meaning that you can travel to more countries visa-free than Americans can. The U.S. passport is also very strong, but I think we have some certain political and, how should I say, geopolitical, I was going to say discussions, but...
Conflicts of interest?
Just conflicts, not necessarily conflicts of interest, where some countries require Americans to get visas before coming to...
Like Russia?
Yeah, Russia, China, mm-hmm. yeah, quite a few, yeah. There are a couple that... I don't know which ones exactly Germans can go without visas where Americans would need one.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of
I say Russia, I kind of mean pre-war. Because I think right now the whole situation is different for everyone. But yeah.
It was so crazy when I was in Amsterdam recently, mm-hmm. and when I came back, there was a guy on the plane behind me. He sounded, I think he was, where was he from? He was Italian, mm-hmm. and some lady was talking to him. I think she was Dutch, and she was asking where he was going, and he was on his way to Moscow. Mm. And everyone was like, well, interesting.
Yeah, how
very
like,
interesting time
what's
to be
the
going
story there.
Yeah, I don't think anyone wanted to ask too much, but so yeah. Then I drove to Chicago and showed up to the consulate, and it just was super weird because it's like an American building, and then you get off at the consulate floor, and then it almost feels like you're in Germany. The security guy was American, but then once you got past security, it's like you're in Germany. I think a lot of the decor, if I remember correctly, like even reminded me of the way that things are in Germany.
Yeah. I wonder, they just have one floor, right? Because I went to the Chicago consulate last year to interview the consul general. But of course, I wasn't there for an interview, so I didn't even have to go through any security.
Ah, which, okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I didn't even notice. Like, now that you say that, I was like, huh, yeah, true. I guess it was because it was like a scheduled appointment for the media, I guess. Ben and I came with all of our filming equipment. I guess it was different. But yeah, for sure, I definitely agree that it felt like Germany, like the office culture was very...
Yeah.
Literally, as I walked in, here's just a little side story. This was a Friday, like afternoon, early afternoon. And so it was someone's birthday, so they were all sitting in the lobby having cake, coffee and cake. And it was like the most German thing in the world.
It's incredible. I love it. I love it. But yeah, you like walk through the security and they're like, okay, I'm in Germany now, basically. Especially because you get a number and then you sit and you wait for your number to be called. And then I go up to this is actually kind of a funny story. I went up, and maybe I've told this before, but my number was called and I went up to the window and they're like these big glass, or not glass, they're plexiglass dividers, basically, where the consulate worker will sit behind the glass and you have your conversation with them. And there's like a little tray where you have to put your documents through. Basically, like you're in a jail.
Yeah, or that.
Yeah, like I like the jail counter example better.
No, I just feel like, you know, when you go like at a train station or, I don't know, theater even sometimes, like movie theaters, and some of them, have that divider and you have the thing where you can slide your money under and then they give you the tickets. Yeah,
exactly. But I walk up to the counter and I think I just said Guten Morgen. Mm-hmm. And then she started speaking German to me and she was like, the first thing that she said was, wait, you're here for a passport, right? I was like, no, I wish. She got very confused because she had the documents ready for, I think she had the documents ready for a visa. And then when I started speaking German to her, she was very confused. And she was like, wait, are you here for a visa or are you here for a passport?
Yeah, because she automatically thought, German. Thought you were native speaker.
Yeah, it just was really funny. But then I said, no, unfortunately, I have to get a visa. I'm just American. And it was like a super, super fast process.
Mm-hmm. Did she ask you any questions?
I think maybe like one or two, but it was all in the documents.
Okay.
I don't think it wasn't, I didn't feel grilled with questions by any means. I think I was surprised by how few questions there were because I've heard horror stories from people trying to come to the US.
Mm, yeah.
So I think mentally I was prepared for the US level of interrogation, which I'm sure we'll hear more about when you start telling your story. But no, it was very simple. And then they kept my passport. They checked all my documents after I left too. And then when everything was fine, they sent me my passport in the mail, which actually they sent it within like 3 days. It was super fast. I don't know why it was so fast, because I think normally it takes a lot longer. But yeah, they called me on the phone too and like just confirmed my address and everything. And then they sent me my passport back.
Nice. But was it confirmed right away that the visa was approved?
I believe so.
Okay.
I believe so. Because I'm trying to think. I don't remember if I had to submit my documentation online before or if I just brought everything with me. But if you have all of your documents and you follow like the online instructions, things work really well. Like I haven't run into an experience yet when I truly had all of the documents and there was an issue. The only thing I can think of was when I got my driver's license here, where I misunderstood something about a erweiterte Meldebestätigung. But that was my fault for not reading correctly.
Yeah, you did tell that story at some point. Yeah. I don't remember which episode it was, but it's been horrible. Told.
Yes, it was horrible. But yeah, it was a really smooth process. They were super nice and basically just said, enjoy your time in Germany. And then I left and then drove 4.5 hours back to Cincinnati. Yeah. And then, yeah, when I moved, it was a very simple process of, I mean, I had my visa and my passport, so I didn't have any problems at the border getting into Germany. And then when I got here, I basically just had to set up a meeting with the Ausländerbehörde, so the foreigner's office. After officially registering with the city, then I was able to get an appointment at the foreigner's office, where then we went over my documentation again. And I actually got the true card of the blue card.
Yeah.
So for the first year I was in Germany, I was on the blue card. That was a little bit more of a complicated process just because it took longer, because you're in country. The resources are stressed more. There are a lot of people submitting documentation to get their papers. So I think it was like a 3-month process to actually get the actual card. But my visa was valid for 6 months, so it wasn't a problem.
So you're still already on that status, you just don't have the physical card.
Exactly.
Yet.
Exactly. So I still had something proving I was there legally or here legally. The one thing that did come up though was I was planning on going back to the US, or I went back to the US for Easter, and I hadn't received it wasn't Easter. I'm trying to remember the exact date, but the issue was my visa and my passport had expired.
Oh, your passport had expired too?
No, not my passport. Oh, no. The visa and my passport.
In the
had
passport,
expired.
Okay.
Yes. Then I also still didn't have my card, but the card was in process. Mm-hmm. So I called the Ausländerbehörde, so the foreigner's office, to ask what to do. And they gave me what's called a Fixionsbescheinigung, which is basically a piece of paper confirming your status of being there legally. Mm-hmm. So I just had that. No one cared when I crossed the border anyway. Okay. But I at least had a piece of paper with an official statement saying I was there legally. So and then I received my blue card in the mail at that time. I think you have to go pick them up now, if I'm not mistaken. But I think because of Corona, they sent them via post. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I had my blue card for a year. Then when I switched employers, I'm going to correct one statement. When I was talking about the blue card earlier, I only mentioned two of the three requirements, that you had to have a degree and that you had a job offer. You also have to make enough money. There's a income threshold for the blue card. So when I changed employers, my structure was a little different, where my base salary was then beneath the threshold for the blue card. So I had to move to a different visa type, which it was really simple. It was not a hard process at all. But with that, it just takes longer to get permanent residency. So with the blue card, you can get permanent residency after paying into the German retirement system for 3 years. And if you speak, I believe, B1 German, it reduces down to 2 years. With a regular Aufenthaltstitel or Aufenthaltserlaubnis or residency permit, it takes 5 years. And if you speak good enough German, it reduces to 4. So that kind of sucked.
That's a good motivation for everyone, whoever plans on moving to Germany, that your German skills can actually help you.
Definitely, definitely. And B1 is not that hard to achieve. Mm-hmm. They want to make sure that people are working towards getting integrated, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, I think actually that makes a lot of sense.
And I think the German system is very fair. I've been dealing with some struggles regarding the Niederlassungserlaubnis, which is the permanent residency. And some of my German friends have been getting all up in arms about like, oh, we need Fachkräfte, we need skilled workers in this country, and they're making it so difficult for you. Like, not really. It's actually quite an easy process. It's a little bit more difficult to get permanent residency, but when you compare it to the US, it's still a very, very easy process, especially if you have a job offer. So I think that's what my recommendation would be to you if you are trying to come to Germany and need a visa to do so, to work. Try to have your interviews before. If you can get everything lined up before moving, that's ideal, and it makes the process go a lot smoother. But there's also the possibility of coming here and finding a job in country. No. Especially if you have a degree, that helps for sure. It's not a prerequisite by any means. There are other visa types that you can get if you don't have a college degree or a university degree, but in my case, that was the easiest. And yeah, so then I switched visa types from the blue card to the regular Aufenthaltserlaubnis, and that's kind of my current state right now. There are some real intricacies regarding the law as far as permanent residency eligibility is concerned. Mm-hmm. So that's why I've been talking about me trying to work on getting my permanent residency. I recently had to take a German test, for example. I don't think I talked about this on...
I think you did.
I know I talked about it in our hangout.
No, but I think you mentioned... I think we recorded the last episode after you took the test.
Okay. Then, yeah. So I had to take a German test to prove that I could speak German. That's another thing, though, regarding permanent residency. If you go to a German university and have a degree in from a German university, you don't have to have that.
Okay.
The proof. So yeah, that's kind of my experience. Is there anything that you think I'm missing out on there, Feli, that I should talk about that you know that I...
No, the only thing that, because you did mention in the last episode that you had the test, but I think you only talked in the hangout about the results of the test.
Okay.
Did you
I passed, pass? Guys. I got C1, which now I'm actually kind of kicking myself in the butt for not trying C2.
Which is the higher language level.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I'm fairly confident I would pass the C2 exam.
from like a normal everyday person perspective, you're 100% C2. Like, is C2 the highest you can get?
Yeah.
Yeah. So like your native level, native speaker level in German. So
exactly. Like, of course the thing with the tests is that they, and I think we've talked about this, they make it difficult. So it's not necessarily about being a native level speaker. It's being the test taker. So
yeah, we did talk about that, and that's just ridiculous. I mean, they need to design tests that are actually targeted towards figuring out someone's language level and not their skill in test taking. Because some people are just bad at taking tests.
It was funny. I recently talked to an immigration lawyer, just was getting a free consultation. And when I told them, obviously we were having the conversation in German. Mm-hmm. And when I told them that I had all of my documents ready I just recently got my certificate for the German test, they laughed and were like, das ist aber lächerlich. Like, it just was ridiculous. A funny experience. That's I'm trying to think if there's anything else important that I should mention. I don't think so. In Germany, it's relatively simple and straightforward. You don't have, as my understanding at least, the whole immigrant visas or non-immigrant visas and the intricacies that Feli will be talking about here in a minute. But it's a pretty straightforward process in Germany. So if you're interested, look at the websites from the German government. There's a website called Make It in Germany, which is from the German government, which does a really good job of explaining different visa types and different ways to get here. That's a resource I would definitely recommend to get information. It's also available in English, so that's a huge plus.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I don't even know that much about how to come to Germany. A lot of people always ask me about it, but obviously since I never had to do it myself, I really have no knowledge on that topic whatsoever. Like, people like you or other people who have moved to Germany will know that much, much better than I do. I mean, that's, you know, not something that I had to deal with ever.
And that's how I feel about the US too. I'm like, I feel so bad for people who try to go to the US because I've heard horror stories from my friends and just know how complicated it can be. So that's why when I'm here in Germany, I'm like, I'm pretty sure compared to the US, this is very, very easy.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm not an expert on the US system at all because I was born there.
Exactly. You had it easy.
If you don't have any questions, Feli, about my story or anything to add to that, then maybe you can tell us a little bit more about your experiences.
Okay. Well, if you at any time feel like I didn't explain anything well enough, just interrupt me and ask follow-up questions. Yeah. But I kind of took a few notes here. As you said, in the US, there's non-immigrant visas and immigrant visas, and there's a bunch of subcategories underneath those. So, like, I'm going to also link something in the description box where you can just get an overview of what kind of visas exist. But, you know, there's, like, visas that are for people who are sent here from their employer. There's visas for people who are engaged to an American citizen. Like, there's literally an engagement visa where you can come here for 3 months to arrange your wedding.
It's crazy.
You know, there's visas for exchange students. Like, I had one of those, au pairs, very skilled workers. Like, there's different levels of, like, skilled workers. Like, if you're, like, super, super skilled and someone who can do a job that nobody else in the US can, you have a
Sorry, that's probably me. I'm sending you these just so I don't forget.
Yeah, no, I forget to turn off my phone. You'll get a different visa, et cetera. So there's a lot of different categories. They all have really, really intriguing names with letters and numbers like B1, J1, A, E3, H1B, blah, blah, blah. I would say one of the most commonly known visa is probably H1B, at least. Yeah. I think that's one that you even probably know
of. Yeah, that's one I know.
That's the most common work visa that a lot of our friends who got their degree in the US, so were an international student in the US and then got a job offer from an employer in the US, that's the visa that they would get. But that's also, like, not easy to get. So just a little foreshadowing on that for an H1B, for example. The employer has to sponsor you for that first. So not only do you have to be able to find a job with an American employer as an international, which is already, like, kind of puts you in a disadvantage towards your fellow American citizens, because this employer will have to go through a lot more work with you if they hire you. So, yeah, but if you do find someone, then they have to sponsor you, which doesn't only cost them money, but also time to fill out forms. So basically, they request the visa for you with the government. They're like, hey, we have this employee. We really would like to keep them. please give them a work visa. That's basically how it works. But then that's not even guaranteed still. It's still then a lottery. So there is a certain time frame. I've never gone through an H-1B process, so I only know this from other people's experience and from what I've researched. But there's like a certain time frame where you have to submit the application, and then each year there's like a deadline, and then there's like the lottery drawing for that year. So like you might be getting a job, and then for a year and a half, like you might have to wait for another year and a half until you actually know if you get a work visa, but also you might not win the lottery. I think they have like, I want to say it was like 60,000 or something along those lines, H-1B visas every year. And you might not be able to get one, because I think from what I understand, it's just like luck, like literally random. Anyways, that's not one of the visas I ever had, but I just wanted to give you like a feeling of how this works in the US. It's very complicated because even getting a sponsor is not easy. Yes, Josh, you raised your hand.
Yeah, I didn't want to interrupt you, but I did want to add one story from my time with my visa experience, because I've heard a lot of these things about H-1Bs in the U.S. and having to prove that the job that you want can't be done by an American.
Right. Yeah.
That's part of the process as well. And I remember I was talking to an advisor here in Germany from the German government about the process, and she was explaining to me that the jobs office, basically the Bundesagentur für Arbeit, has to look over the contract. And I said, oh, yeah, to make sure that there's not a German who can do the job. She said, no, we're not the U.S. She said it's to make sure that the employer isn't taking advantage of you as a worker.
Oh, my God.
That they're basically paying you enough.
Wow.
But yes. Yeah. I wanted to give you that hint of, or the insight into the different mentality between the two countries.
That's crazy. But I could see that because, I mean, Germany definitely gets more workers from like Eastern Europe, where they can get cheaper labor. So that actually does make sense. But also, as we talked about in the last episode, labor laws are just a little bit stronger and protecting employees. But yeah, so there's non-immigrant and immigrant visas. Most of the visas I ever had, and probably what most people ever had, if any of you have ever had a U.S. visa before, was a non-immigrant visa, which includes, for example, the au pair visa or exchange student visa or even just regular international student visa if you just come here for the full university experience. It also includes the tourist visa or the visa that Germans and many other people can get, the visa waiver, like ESTA, where you don't actually have to get a physical visa, but it's more like a very sped up visa process where you just have to apply online and you get a confirmation and then you just bring that printout to immigration when you enter the country. ESTA for Germans is a 90-day thing, kind of like what you mentioned with Americans going to Germany. So like Germans can enter the U.S. as a tourist. I think, pretty sure, that the requirement is that you cannot work. So like I don't think it includes business purposes.
No business travel
Does
is allowed.
It? Okay. Mm-hmm. But you're not allowed to make money in the U.S. on that.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you're a German working for, and you have a German work contract and you come into the U.S. For a business trip, you don't need anything special. You can just use the ESTA.
Yeah. Okay. So that's like one of those things where you just have to go online, fill out a bunch of forms, kind of similar to the forms that I had to fill out for my actual visas. But you don't have to go anywhere in person and give them your passport. And you're not going to have like a physical visa glued into your passport or anything like that. But then you can enter for 90 days at a time. And it's, I think, very similar to what you described. I think you... I haven't done it in so long that I don't fully remember, but I think it's like 90 days in the country and then you have to leave for 90 days and then you can come back. But if you do that, guys, just look it up. I do know that the ESTA is valid for 2 years. So, for example, if you want to come on several trips to the U.S., you don't have to request a new ESTA for 2 years. So you can just reuse that ESTA the next time you come to the U.S. if it's like a year later.
And I know for most countries as well, like I know I have a couple Latin American friends, they apply for a tourist visa for the U.S. If your country isn't part of the ESTA program, then normally those tourist visas are valid for 10 years.
Yes, that is correct. And I know that because I have one of those.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but basically one of the main things to keep in mind whenever you have a non-immigrant visa, whether it's for the visa interview, if you do a visa interview for one of these other visas, or at the actual point of entry, so aka when you go through the immigration process at the airport when you enter the country, is that you cannot show any intention of immigration. So you cannot have any immigration intent is what how they phrase it. So like, you cannot come there, show your non-immigrant visa and be like, oh yeah, I'm planning on moving here forever. They're not going to let you in if you say that, because the whole purpose of the non-immigrant visas is that it's just temporary. And in a lot of cases, they will even ask you for your flight back. So ideally, you'll already have that booked and have that confirmation with you. And you can show, yeah, look, my flight back is scheduled for, you know, in 2 months. And then in a lot of cases, they'll also ask you about your ties to your home country and why you're coming back to your home country. So basically what they're trying to do is just make sure that you're not using one of these non-immigrant visas, which in a lot of cases are relatively easy to get. Like in ESTA, for example, where you don't even have to do an interview, it's pretty easy to get if you don't have like a criminal record. So they just want to make sure you're not using that to enter the country and then just stay indefinitely and just use that for basically then illegal immigration. But those are the two main categories. I have had a few different non-immigrant visas, and then at the end, of course, now I have a green card that counts as an immigrant visa. So here is my story with my visas. The first one that I had.
Can I just interrupt briefly? I wanted to add too, because when I was talking about the German system, I was talking a lot about my perspective, which was for a work visa. But of course, there are other visa statuses for Germany that don't allow you to work, such as student visas, I think, have some stipulation for what they call mini jobs.
Yep.
But there are large restrictions on the amount of money that you can make. So I just wanted to put that out there as well, as my focus was on work visas, but there are other visas as well. If your spouse, for example, is German, you can get a visa here. It doesn't necessarily mean that it permits you to work. So there are details in the German system as well that I didn't go into because I don't have experience with them, but just wanted to mention that. But now back to your story.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest issues in general, I think, is just like, if you are on a certain visa, how much are you allowed to work? Where are you allowed to work? Do you have to work in a certain field? Can you only work in certain areas? So like, I'll get into that because, for example, on a student visa in the US, you're only allowed to work on campus. Except there's like certain exceptions, but like generally, so you can work with a professor, for example, as like a teaching assistant or something like that, or because American campuses are kind of like little towns, you can work at like the university Starbucks or something like that and serve food, but they don't usually allow you to work off campus. So yeah, the visas that I had were a J1, which is for exchange students or exchange visitors, among other things. Like, as I said, that's also the one for au pairs, for example. Then I had a B1/B2, which is the tourist visa, which I will get into that, why I had that. And then I had an F1 visa, which is for degree-seeking international students. So if you're not just on an exchange program and you're still enrolled with your home university, but you're actually coming to the US and you're fully enrolled at the American university and you're getting a degree from that university. And then after that, I got my DV visa for diversity lottery visa, which then led to my green card. The processes were pretty similar for most of these. So I'll just like tell you how it was for the first visa, for the J1. Basically, for those visas, you always need a sponsor. Also, like what I said with the work visa before, in these cases, when you're, for example, a student, the sponsor is the university. That's just like as soon as they accept you into their exchange program or just as a regular student, they basically consent to being your legal sponsor. And they will give you a document. And for the J1, I think it was called DS-2019. Not that that's relevant to any of you right now, but they'll basically give you a document that is very relevant for you to then move forward with the whole visa process. And that document will just include a bunch of your information that you've previously submitted with the university. So that was like the first step, was waiting for the document. And I remember the second time when I came back from my master's program, it took so long for them to give me that document that my visa was like super last minute. Like, I think I didn't get the document until June. And then I had to make sure I still got a visa interview in July. I was supposed to come here at the end of July. So it was all like very last minute because I couldn't do anything without that sponsor document. Mm-hmm. But once you have that, you usually then have to fill out these online forms. I think for non-immigrant visas, it's called a DS-160. For immigrant visas, it's a DS-260. Also like something that most of you probably don't really need to know right now, but they're basically these really, really long forms that ask you about everything in your life, pretty much. Like they're going to ask for, it's going to take a while to fill those out. It's like your address, all the addresses you've lived at in the last 5 years, all the jobs you've had in the last five That's years crazy. With employer contacts. All the countries you've traveled to in the last however many years with like the exact months when you entered that country and left that country, etc. And then also a bunch of these really, they're almost like infamous questions. If
the German one is nowhere close to that detailed. Like it wants to know when like your last two stays in Germany were, your first time ever entering Germany, like, and like your parents' names and addresses. Like that's pretty much it.
Yeah. I might also, I'm just kind of quoting that from memory right now. I definitely know that you need to list all of your previous stays in the US very detailed. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't need to list the months for the countries you've been to, but they definitely ask about certain countries you've been to.
Makes
sense. See, I don't want to say anything wrong there, but I definitely know that if you've been to Iraq, for example, you're going to not get an ESTA approved. Or if you apply for a regular visa, they're going to ask a lot of follow-up questions about that. And there's like certain countries, or Iran too, if you've been to certain countries, just visit it. Like no political connections whatsoever. Just visited that country. That might already put you in trouble. But yeah, then of course they have all these infamous questions like, do you seek to engage in espionage, sabotage, export control violations, or any other illegal activity while in the United States? And you have to click yes or no. Or of course, do you seek to engage in terrorist activities while in the United States, or have you ever engaged in terrorist activities? Yes or no?
It's crazy.
Where's the other one that I wanted to read with prostitution?
Do you intend to engage in illegal prostitution or something?
So basically, yes. I can't find it right now. But yeah, also, have you ever supported terrorist organizations? Have you ever participated in human trafficking? Like all these, you know, very interesting questions where, of course, if you click yes for only one of them, you're already going to be flagged and probably not going to get your visa.
I feel like you would have to take so much time to read each question so carefully, because yes or no questions I feel like can be worded really trickily sometimes.
Yeah. I think in these forms, for the most part, you have to click no for everything from what I remember, but definitely make sure you read them. That is the form. It's, as I said, very long. And then you usually have to pay a fee with it too, which is not cheap. How did you have to pay money for your visa?
Yeah. It wasn't much though. Never more than 200 euros. I think maximum, I think was 75 euros. I think for my visa, it was close to 70. And then I think also for my blue card, it was close to 100.
Okay.
And then my company paid for the most recent one. So I don't know how much it was.
Yeah, I don't currently have all the information in front of me. I didn't look into all my previous documents for like how much I paid for each visa, but it was definitely always around like 200, and sometimes there were several fees that I had to pay. So there were definitely a few visas where it was more like, you know, 300 or so for the visa. You definitely have to pay a fee and then also bring that receipt, and then finally when all of that is approved, when you've paid the fee, when that first online form is approved and you haven't clicked that you're a terrorist, then you're going to be eligible to schedule a visa interview. And when you're in Germany and you want to go to the US, there's a few different places where you can go. I think it's like four or so different consulates, and I think the embassy in Berlin that you can go to. And not all of them process everything. So like, for example, we do have a an American consulate in Munich, which was awesome because for my first visa, I didn't have to travel anywhere. I didn't have to do that 4-hour drive anywhere. But they don't do immigrant visas, for example. So for my green card, I did have to go to Frankfurt specifically to do my interview there. But yeah, for the J1 visa, I just had to schedule that interview in the American consulate. And then it's like a whole experience. You get there.
And I really want to go.
Kind of prepare. The one in Munich is really small. It's like this little bunker.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't have a second floor or anything like that. You just go in and it's just like one big room pretty much. But you cannot bring, I think this is the case for all American consulates, you cannot bring a phone in.
I think it was that way for the German consulate as well, that like you had to turn your phone in.
But maybe they've changed it by now, but I do remember that specifically for the one in Munich and also the one in Frankfurt, they didn't have any storage solutions for you. They didn't have any lockers or anything like that. I don't know how you handled it, if you just left it in your car.
I don't remember.
But at least in Munich, I remember that one time because, you know, you don't drive there. It's like pretty downtown. It's in the Königinstraße right by the English Garden. There's no parking there. I mean, at least, you know, good luck with that. It's not something that a Munich person would do. So, of course, I took public transportation and I left my phone at home. And I remember that it felt so weird being on public transportation, not knowing. I didn't even have a watch. I didn't know what time it was until like I saw the time at the train stations. Anyways, whole weird experience. You can't bring your phone. And then, of course, you go through security, like, you know, American standard security. And it's kind of weird also getting there in Munich or in Germany in general, because as soon as you get there, you have these American cops with their big sticks and their guns and their just American uniforms.
Yeah.
And it just seems a little out of place. It's just like you're in the English Garden pretty much. It's very peaceful. And you walk up there and suddenly there's like four people fully armed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's always interesting when you walk by and you see them out.
Yeah.
You're like, I feel like I'm home.
Home, sweet home.
Yes.
But yeah, you just walk in and then I think you had to get a number. And then it's basically the same thing that you described, that you go up to one of those windows. Then the exception is that they do grill you a little bit. And I remember for my very first visa, I was completely like a blank page, as you would say in German. I don't know how you would say that in English. An unwritten... I didn't have any previous interaction with the U.S. whatsoever, right?
Okay.
I was completely innocent. They didn't have any information on me. So even then, they asked me all these questions. Why are you coming back after your exchange semester? Why do you want to go there to begin with? What are you studying? What are your ties to your home country? As I said, that's a very important question. Then you say things like, I have an apartment here. You might even need to bring your lease to show that you still have a lease that is going longer than your stay, so that you have a reason to come back. I have family here. I have a relationship here. Like, you have to kind of explain, or like, I have a job here. Why? What are the reasons that you would want to come back to this country? They're almost like assuming that the U.S. is the best country in the world anyway. So like, why wouldn't you want to stay?
Yes.
So that was like a lot of the interview, I remember. And it was definitely a little intimidating. And of course, it's in English. But I mean, that's just normal. But it was definitely just a little intimidating. And I remember the one in Munich is also relatively small and everyone can kind of hear what you're saying.
Yeah. I wanted to add one thing too, because I forgot about the English thing. This is something I wanted to talk about in the introduction to this episode too. I do not remember you ever having such a strong German accent until your most, it wasn't your most recent video, but one of your most recent videos, you played an audio clip of your accent when you were at the University of Cincinnati the first time. And you sound so German compared to how you sound now. It's crazy.
I do think... I'm not saying like that's my defense, but I almost think that my accent was stronger in the recording,
because
I feel like that's still even the case nowadays. When I like read a script on camera, I feel like I have a stronger accent than when I'm just talking.
Yeah.
So that might make a slight difference, but probably
still,
not that big of a difference. Yeah.
I don't think it makes that big of a difference. It just blew my mind because I don't remember you ever sounding like that. But sorry, that's a complete aside.
I did.
And that's how you probably sounded during your interview.
Yeah, for sure. Even worse, because at that time I hadn't even been to the U.S. I mean, I had been to the U.S. a couple of times as a tourist, but yeah. Anyways, then they basically tell you right away that it's approved, or if it's approved or not approved. And then what happens, I mean, that's what you said too, you just leave your passport there, and then they send it to you via mail with the visa in it, few days or a few weeks later. Mm-hmm. So what's really important for these things also is that you make sure that your passport, it has at least another 6 months before it expires. That's always very relevant for these kinds of things.
Yeah.
But yeah, then I got my passport with the visa in the mail. And then for this specific visa, you are allowed to enter the U.S. 30 days before the period that is printed onto the visa, which in my case was literally just the semester term. So like the first day of the semester and the last day of the semester was the time period that I had the visa for. And then I was allowed to enter 30 days prior and stay for another 30 days afterwards. That's where the fun story comes in.
Yes.
But that's the visa experience pretty much. And I would say with the green card, like with my other visas, it was pretty much the same. With the green card, there was definitely a few extra steps, but I'll probably share that later on, mm-hmm. like towards the end of the episode. Wait, do you have any questions so far?
Not so far, no. Okay. It's what I'm used to.
Yes. So here is the overstay story.
Yes, pray tell.
So after the semester was over, you have that 30 days for the J1 visa. I think for the F1, for example, it's 60 days. But in my case, it was 30 days. It's called the grace period, where you have time to leave the country, but you can't technically like re-enter the country during that time. So like basically your visa is expired, but you get 30 days to pack your stuff, say goodbye to everyone and leave the country. Now I, at the time, also if you guys have seen one of my most recent videos, I talked about that. I had a relationship in Cincinnati at the time, and that was not the only reason, but that was definitely one of the reasons why I was like, I would just like to stay a little bit longer.
With an American. And,
yeah, with an American. And I also didn't have anything going on in Germany at the time because that was my last semester of my undergrad. And I didn't have any commitments. I didn't have like a date that I had to be back in Germany by because classes started or anything like that. So I was like, you know what? If I can, it would be cool if I could just stay a little bit longer, like another month or so. So I got in touch with Customs and Border Protection of the U.S. in November. The semester was over in December and I had to leave in January. So I got in touch with them 2 months prior and I asked them if it's possible to leave the country and then re-enter on an ESTA, so on a tourist visa. Because on the internet, there was a bunch of contradicting information on that. A lot of people said it was possible. A lot of other people said it wasn't possible unless you travel pretty far. So like I couldn't just travel to Canada or Mexico and re-enter. But that was kind of my plan, was like maybe just I could go to Canada and then re-enter. So basically, the internet didn't really give me a clear answer on this. So then I asked the actual experts, and they told me, and I still have these emails to this day, that that's possible. It literally said, here, let me read it.
I love it. You have your emails pulled up.
It says, you can travel to Mexico, Canada, or another country and re-enter the U.S. with the visa waiver program. All you need is your passport to re-enter by land or ferry. You need an ESTA to re-enter by commercial airline or cruise ship. Oh, you don't even need the ESTA if you... See, I didn't even know that.
Maybe that was your problem.
I don't know. It would be good to have a copy of your travel reservations or airline tickets so the CBP officers can tell you will leave the U.S. within 90 days. So like just what I said, always helpful to have your flight back scheduled already and show that. So basically what they're telling me is, okay, cool. You can go to Canada throughout your grace period. So after your visa has expired and then just re-enter on a new status. So I did that in January of 2017, went to Canada, had my ESTA and everything ready, even though I guess they said I didn't even need it, but I think I just wanted to have it anyways. Mm-hmm. So I had my ESTA ready. And as we re-entered to the US via car, the officer, like I gave him my ESTA, he looked at it and he was just like, you're all good to go, have fun. So I'm like, cool, everything worked out. Like I re-entered the country on a tourist visa. Well, a few days later, I checked my status online because there was like a platform basically where you can check your current immigration status,
yeah,
I guess.
Uh-huh.
And it still shows that I'm here on my J1 visa that is about to expire, like I think in 2 days or so. And they're not technically allowed to let you back in on that visa during that grace period. So basically, somehow, I still don't know to this day what the fuck happened, but this border control officer let me back on a visa that wasn't even, he wasn't allowed to put me back on that status. And I don't know what he thought why I gave him my tourist visa information. I don't know if he just didn't put it into the database correctly or what happened there. But he basically let me in illegally on the wrong status that he wasn't supposed to let me back in on. And I didn't realize until a few days later when it was already to... Actually, I think I was already over the grace period when I figured it out. So then I panicked because I was basically at that point, I was there illegally. I was like, fuck.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So I called a bunch of different numbers. I think the one that I finally talked to was the border control or border protection in at the Cincinnati airport. Mm-hmm. And the lady there told me that that's not good. Obviously, you're here legally. And I was like, but I really tried not to. Like, I tried my best. Yeah. And like, I didn't only get this one email response from Customs and Border Control. It was several different people who messaged me back because I had a few follow-up questions.
Yeah.
You know, they messaged me back and it was a different officer every time. And mm-hmm. they all like said it would work. Anyways, it's very frustrating.
I remember this was such a nightmare for you.
And she said, well, not good. You need to leave the country ASAP. I already had my flight booked for a few days after that. So I was like, is it early enough if I leave in 3 days? And she was like, yeah, that's fine. Doesn't make a difference now. Like, basically, I was like, well, do I need overstayed. To leave today? Yeah, she was like, it doesn't make a difference if you overstay 5 days or 8 days. Because I was like, do I need to like literally leave right now? Because I was freaking out. And she was like, no, it's fine if you leave in 3 days. And I was like, am I going to have problems leaving the country or re-entering the country? And she was like, no, it should be fine. Other people overstay over 180 days. And apparently that's like kind of a threshold. If you stay longer than 180 days, then that's a problem. But she said,
lies,
you should be fine.
Lies.
Yeah. So then... A few months later, I came back here. I wanted to come back here on a tourist visa to pretty much visit my boyfriend. I think it was your birthday too.
Yeah.
That was like May of 2017.
When you say tourist visa, do you mean S or do you mean ESTA. You got actually? Okay. Yeah.
Uh-huh. ESTA. Yeah. And I kind of thought, you know, it'll be fine because the lady said it's fine. So then I'm at the immigration at the airport and they're pulling me out into secondary inspection. And I had never experienced that before. I mean, I had only been to the US a few times before that. The way they do that is kind of scary. Like, you go to your counter where you have your normal immigration interview where they just ask you questions. And then they just like stop saying anything. And they click a button and they don't tell you anything. And then another officer comes and they give your passport to the other officer and they're like, you follow them. And it's just, it's weird.
It's so scary.
So I followed them and I didn't really know what secondary inspection was.
And you weren't
in
Cincinnati, you were...
In Chicago.
Think, yeah.
Yeah, and honestly, I think Chicago is like one of the worst airports for that because they're very, very strict there and very crowded. Like, it's just, they're dealing with so many people every day.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I then go to that room. They put the passport away. Like, you don't get your passport back. You also can't use your phone yet again. And I was in this big waiting room with wooden benches and a bunch of people. And you weren't allowed to look on your phone, as I said, or do anything. You weren't allowed to eat or drink. And then I sat there for like over an hour. And they don't tell you what's next. They don't tell you what's going to happen. You don't have your luggage. Your luggage is waiting for you somewhere.
And you're waiting for your connecting flight.
I missed my connection. And I'm just sitting there. I can't contact anyone. Because like... If you're at your destination also and someone's picking you up, you can't tell them that you're... Anyways, I was in the secondary inspection. I waited for over an hour. And I remember that I was pretty shocked by the situation there.
Yeah.
I will say I've been to other secondary inspections since. So this one was probably the worst one, but it was just very crowded. There was a woman with a baby. There was an elderly woman. They were all just sitting on these wooden benches. And the elderly woman asked if she was allowed to drink anything. And they were like, no. But at the same time, these American cops, and in my memory, in this particular situation, these were very stereotypical, like kind of bigger American cops. And he was walking around with a hot dog. And I was like, are you kidding me right now?
Just flaunting it in front of you guys.
And they were just chit-chatting like with each other, the cops, and you were just sitting there. And I was like, this poor woman, like she does not look well. Anyways, they basically treat you like criminals there. Some of these people might be criminals. That's possibly
I'm sure there's like a reason why they can't eat or drink, because they might be like mules for drugs and like that type of stuff, but still crazy.
Still, it's just, especially you're not being told why you're brought there. And so I didn't really understand why I was being brought there. I mean, I thought it was probably about that, but I didn't really know, like, did I do something wrong with my ESTA or, yeah. Anyways, there was another German there that I saw because I saw his passport. Mm-hmm. He was allowed to leave. And I said, hey, like, why are you here? And he was like, oh, I've been to Iraq before.
Okay.
And so he kind of talked to me for a brief second and kind of explained what was going on. Mm-hmm. And yeah, after a long waiting period, they called me into an interrogation room. And then it was a one-on-one interrogation with this cop that basically just asked me, why do you have this overstay? Why are you here? Are you trying to get married? Like, they were all scared that I'm coming here to, like, stay illegally, as I said earlier. Like, who's your boyfriend? Blah, blah. Because I said, like, I'm visiting my boyfriend. And they wanted to know everything. Name, occupation, like, check the whole story. And I was so shocked because I didn't know that I was about to get in trouble.
Especially because the lady told you that, like, you were under 180 days, so it shouldn't really be that big of an issue.
I should have probably researched it more, but I thought, okay, you know what? I checked with them. They said it's fine. I was just very naive. I thought, okay, it's going to be fine. And I had already just traveled, like, for a full day, and I was exhausted, obviously, and I had been waiting there. I didn't know what was going on. And he grilled me so hard that I started crying. And then he was like, why are you crying? I mean, I was, okay, I wasn't like that young at the time, but I was, early 20s. But still, I was just like, I was alone. I didn't have anyone with me. It was just a very dumb situation. And then he, like, asked me really stupidly why I was crying, and I was like, are you kidding me? Like, because he literally told me that he cannot let me in. And so that's when I started crying, is when I was like, okay, great, so now I just wasted however many dollars, like several hundred dollars on a flight that is not getting me anywhere, and now I have to go back home. That's not the kind of information that you want to get when you travel to a country. So then he eventually let me in, because he believed my story, and he said, he was just very condescending. He was all like, I don't have to let you in, but I'm nice, so I will. And it was just like, and I'm not trying to, like, hate on the American Border Protection, but this particular officer is not friendly. And I'm sure a lot of other people who are in secondary inspection have a similar experience.
Yeah.
So he did let me in eventually, and I got my passport back, and then I just went through customs and then figured out how to get to Cincinnati, because then I had to book a new flight, which was cool.
That really sucks. I mean, what's really bad, like, is none of it was intentional from your side. You know,
not at all.
You truly tried to do all of the due diligence you could. And I think in the future, every time you traveled before you got your green card, you made sure you had the print off of the emails.
Yeah, because I needed to, every time I had a visa interview after that, I was asked about this. And I even had to click on these forms that I talked about. There is a question where it's like, have you ever overstayed a visa? Yeah, and I have to click yes. And then you have to explain why. So that's the other reason why I then afterwards didn't have an ESTA anymore, because you can't have an ESTA if you have an overstay.
Okay, now it makes sense. I was like, why did you have a tourist visa? Yeah,
but I also had the tourist visa because I could stay for 6 months with that at a time. And that was when I did the thing with the Over the Rhine Museum, mm-hmm. which was a nonprofit organization. And the tourist visa also works if you want to do volunteering for a nonprofit organization.
Mm-hmm.
That's allowed on a tourist visa as long as you don't make any money. So that's one of the next things that I did after the exchange semester, was I came back on that. And then firstly, I needed it anyways because I couldn't have an ESTA anymore, but also ESTA would have only allowed me 90 days, and mm-hmm. the actual tourist visa that you interview for allows you to stay for six months.
Okay,
so
interesting.
180 days. Yeah, and for that, I also had to have an interview again, basically same story, but that one also was approved. So I basically had to prove, as you said, that it wasn't an intentional overstay, that I really tried everything to do this properly and legally. Mm-hmm. But I definitely kind of felt played a little bit by the system, because I was like, dude, I mean, I could have just gone home, I guess, but I really tried. I reached out to them, to the experts. I was like, hey, how can I make this happen? Can I make this happen? They're like, yep, you're all good to go. Just go to Canada. I do that, doesn't work out, and I'm screwed. And I mean, up until my green card interview, I always had to explain that situation again and again.
Now, I do have a question. In Germany, I know this from a lot of foreign friends in the US, that whenever they have anything with their visa, they have to leave the country and then they can come back. Like if they have to get their visas renewed, they have to leave the country and mm-hmm. get it renewed at a consulate outside of the US and then they can come back. I've never heard of that in Germany. People just go to the foreigner's office. But is there anything like the foreigner's office in the US that you know of that you've had to interact with?
I just know that for when I was on my F1 later on and I then got the
F1 is what?
Student visas, like regular student visa. Yes. And then got the green card. I was able to pick between two different tracks. I could do adjustment of status, which would mm-hmm. mean that I would do it within the US. Uh-huh. Or I could do consular processing or something like that, what it was called, where you mm-hmm. go back home and you do it through a consulate. And so I don't remember which authority does the adjustment of status, but it's definitely a US authority that then processes all of that. I remember it would have taken longer, but I would have just had to go to one of their offices in the US and do an interview there. Yeah. So that was possible for that. But I don't know if it's possible for non-immigrant visas.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's just interesting because I've never heard, like, I feel like most Germans have heard of the Ausländerbehörde before. I don't know any Americans who know of like a foreigner's office.
Yeah.
In Cincinnati, at least. Maybe it's, I don't know. It's just completely out of what I'm used to. But yeah. That was just my question in between. I'm sure people were dying to know how it worked then with your green card. Or were there any...
Was dying there anything to between? Know. I'm sure most of you guys are asleep, I know.
this has been a nice long episode too. But
At least I finally told the overstay story.
Yes.
Moral of the story is don't ever overstay your visa under any circumstances. And if you do, make sure that you get in touch with an immigration lawyer or something.
Yeah.
Don't do what I did. And if you're ever being pulled out for a secondary inspection at the U.S. airport, or even when you enter by a car, that's happened to me too, a few times actually. One time with my family when we were just tourists before any of this happened. And it was I think it was just because they didn't have that many people across the border there.
So they were bored?
And they just... I think so, because it was just two cars. It was us and another family, and we were both called inside, and then we had to all be interviewed separately from each other, like my parents and my brother and I, and they took our car keys too, and anyways, those situations literally make you feel like you're a criminal. Just remember that you're not, and if you did everything right, you're going to be fine, but the secondary inspection situation is definitely annoying, especially because you can't contact anyone. And I know of stories also where like two friends enter the US and they're in separate lines, and then one of the friends gets pulled into secondary inspection and the other friend's just waiting there for hours and they don't know what to do.
they don't know
if they should go and take the connection flight. And I mean, sometimes this just happens if you're from a certain country, right? Like if you're a German citizen even, but you have dual citizenship with Turkey or Syria or another country that might make you look suspicious, then you might just be pulled out. Anyway, with the green card, as you guys know, I won the green card lottery. Long story. I have two videos on that, so I'm going to link those because it goes much more into detail. But to summarize it, I applied for the green card lottery in the fall of 2017. And here's like a whole discussion if one of you is currently thinking about doing that. As I said earlier, when you're on a non-immigrant visa, you cannot show any immigration intent. And so a lot of people think that they cannot play the green card lottery because it would show immigration intent and then would basically make you have to leave the country because you can't stay on that non-immigrant visa because of that. But that's not true, actually. So apparently legally, and I'm living proof of that, you can play the green card lottery, but if you win, you cannot then submit those forms. So like once you submit those forms, it does show immigration intent. But just playing the green card lottery or even winning the green card lottery does not. Just in case this is relevant for anyone, because it was very relevant for me, because a friend of mine always thought that she couldn't participate in the green card lottery because of that. Anyways, you can, and I did, and the first time I did, I won. It's a long process, though, because you don't find out until like 6 months later. So I played it in fall of 2017, found out in May of 2018. Then I headed towards my master's in the US, which was on that F1 visa. And then I remember for the F1 visa already, they asked me about it because I had the F1 visa interview after I won the green card lottery, and the F1 is also a non-immigrant visa. So they were like, oh, so I see you won the green card lottery. So are you trying to move to the US? And I was just like, yeah, I just played it and I won it, but I don't plan on getting a green card. Like, that's not my plan anymore. So that was fine. I got through with that. But I remember I was very nervous if that was reasons to deny me the other visa. It worked out, luckily. And then a year later, when I was done with my master's in now May of 2019, is when I then finally filed my application to the green card.
If you win the green card lottery, you can wait to submit for how long?
Yeah, no, not really. So the thing is, you win it for a certain fiscal year. And so I found out in May of 2018, and that fiscal year that I won it for started 2019. Half a year later. So it was, it was 2018, 2019. I think the fiscal year is called 2019, but so it starts in fall of 2018 and then went for a whole year. So like September of 2018 through September of 2019, something like that. And throughout that year, you have to make sure that your whole green card gets processed. If you start the process, but it doesn't get finished by the end of the year, well, bad luck. So I basically, winning the green card lottery doesn't ensure that you actually get a green card. You might have bad luck because there is a certain order. As I said, I have videos about this because it's so complicated, but you basically get a number assigned at first, and that's the processing number. And that's just random. You can't do anything about that. You literally get that number when you win. And if your number is pretty high and the authorities in your country that are processing this, or the authorities that are responsible for your country, because it's like different by region.
Yeah.
African countries are handled differently than your European countries, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. But if they process it pretty slowly, you might just not get a chance anymore.
I remember like that was a thing, like wondering if you're like, I felt like it got down to like the last few, like,
yeah,
it was really close. And we were wondering if your number, if you were going to get processed or not.
Yeah, I was just pretty nervous, like in those moments that, you know, just like having won the green card lottery that I wasn't going to get the visa anymore. And then later on, the whole situation was just that I didn't know if my number was still going to be called within the time, because everything throughout that year that I had won for, the numbers moved super, super slow. So like every month you could get to see where the cutoff is of the numbers that get to interview. And it was just extremely slow. And it didn't look like my number was even going to be called in time anymore. So the whole problem with that was that you need to submit that form, the DS-260, mm-hmm. with all the questions, right? In time, so that like if you do get your number called, that you have that submitted already. But no, the other problem was that once you submit that, you have shown clear immigrant intentions. So then I was like, okay, great. So if I submit that, but then my number doesn't get called anymore, then I can never get another non-immigrant visa ever again, basically. So then I'm screwed. Then I've like ruined all my shots. Yes. So then the good thing happened is that suddenly in like May of 2019, the numbers started moving super quickly, so out of nowhere. And I was like, okay. And so my number suddenly got called already, which was like still half a year before the time was over.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just submitted it super quickly as I saw that. And then everything got processed really quickly, which was good. And then I had my green card interview in Germany, because that's the thing. I could have done it in the US, but then basically that would have taken a long time. And because they would have adjusted my status from student status to green card status.
Because it changed while you were still a student, right? Had you finished your master's yet?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, but okay. I was still on that same status.
Okay.
I was still on the student status, and it's super complicated. I had already actually gotten a work permit for my OPT, which is a whole other thing. Basically, long story short, I was still on the F1 status. And then I could have decided to do the adjustment of status, which would have meant that I'd do everything from the U.S., but that usually takes a little bit longer, and then I wouldn't have been able to go home throughout the whole time until everything is processed. So that would have probably meant that I couldn't have gone home for like a whole year, and I didn't want to do that. So I was like, you know what, the other option seems faster, and also I can go home. Mm-hmm. So yeah, then I went home. I scheduled that interview for August. Well, you kind of have to wait until you get the invitation that you are now allowed to schedule your interview. It's like a whole thing. And then I went home to do the interview. A couple other things that you have to do for your green card is that I had to go to get a medical examination. at licensed physician in Germany. There's only a few throughout the whole country that are licensed to do that for US standards. Yeah. And that costs a lot of money, and it included like just a whole like eye examination, just general health and a lung
X-ray. It seems so like a lot of it seems really outdated.
Yeah, they did a lung X-ray to see if I have tuberculosis, which is crazy because like all these other tourists can just go in without a lung X-ray.
I know, that's what I'm saying. A lot of it seems really, really outdated.
Yeah, but that's just still part of the green card thing. So you have to have that in time. It's all pretty difficult about the timing because you have to have that in time so that the results are already there when you have the interview, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then I had to get my police record from Germany to make sure that, like, to prove that I don't have any criminal record. There was a few extra documents that I didn't need from my other visas. I had to pay more money also. I'm trying to think.
I just want to put a pause here real quick.
Yeah.
And say, I mean, of course, I want people to come to the U.S. legally. Like, if you're going to come, I don't support illegal immigration.
Yeah.
Like, that, I do not support that. Like, that's not okay in my books. For all of you people, though, who say do it the legal way, please look at this experience and tell me how anyone, especially people who aren't necessarily, like, who are more working class, first of all, have the time to do all of this. And secondly, I mean, it's so much bureaucracy that you have to go through to do it the legal way. Like, it's so difficult. So when people just say people need to come legally, I don't think they understand what that really entails. So please look at this experience and see how difficult it can be.
Yeah, and I'm a privileged, like, white German girl with a college degree and skills. But it's very difficult to get a green card. Like, the only options really are if it's through your employer, which means that you have to have an employer to begin with, which is very difficult if you're not a U.S. citizen, because a lot of them don't want to sponsor anyone. But also there's, like, certain requirements. If it's after your student visa, like, for example, if I hadn't gotten the green card and I hadn't applied for the green card, I would have probably tried to get a job on that. Basically, after you get a degree in the U.S. as a student, you can work in that field legally for another year. Mm-hmm. It's called optional practical training. But I could have only worked in the field of that degree. I could have only worked in a job that was directly related to German studies. Yeah. And it's just, it's pretty wild. Anyways, for the green card.
Sorry, I just was going to add one more thing before people come after me for getting political. Like, I'm not even saying that the U.S. needs to accept more immigrants. That's not what I'm saying. All I'm saying is the process needs to be simplified.
Yes, I agree with that.
I'm just advocating for a simplification of the process.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, the only other ways, as I said, through your employer, you can get a green card. If they start the process for you, you could get married, which obviously is an option that many people try to do, but it's not guaranteed. And if you do like a fake marriage, that's obviously very dangerous and they're going to try and catch you with that. Or you can win the green card lottery. There really isn't that many other options to obtain a green card. And same thing with like just regular visas. I mean, of course, there are ways to come over. But for your normal person, especially if you're young, the main way to come to the U.S. is literally university. That's the best and easiest and most straightforward way. Because getting a work visa, if you're pretty unexperienced, isn't that easy either, because they have to prove that they can't have an American do this job. Yeah. Which, if you're young and unexperienced, they probably can't claim that. So it's difficult.
Even then, we have friends and acquaintances that we know who really, I would have, like, I think the U.S. definitely would have benefited from having them be in the United States workforce. But they were unable to find a company that was willing to sponsor them. So they had to go back to their home country.
Yeah. And that happens a lot. And
Yeah.
Anyway, so like when you're young, trying to go to university is the best way to do, or au pair is also very common and popular. But even just a regular paid internship, you have to basically then pay a company that functions as a sponsor for that. It's all complicated. Getting back to the green card process. Yes. So the one thing that was different about it was the medical examination. And then also, for this one, similar to what you said, you have to prove your financial resources. So you have to show them that you have enough money to support yourself, to at least survive for the first few months in case you don't have a job or don't find a job. And if you can't show financial resources, it doesn't have to be all cash. It could do, it could be other income streams like your landlord or something like that. Or you have a job lined up. I think that was always helpful. That wasn't really like a number that they gave you. It was more like in the online forums, people said the ballpark is like 10,000 per person and then like 5,000 per additional family member if it's a whole family applying. But that's a lot of money that you kind of have to show that you have access to that somehow. And if you don't, the other option is that you can basically have an American citizen, if you know someone who is an American citizen, vouch for you. So basically they then have to sign something. To be your financial sponsors, just to make sure that, like, in case you do get in trouble financially, that you don't have to rely on the American welfare system, basically. So that's that. Other than that, as I said, I had to pay a few extra fees. The green card was definitely the most expensive one. And oh yeah, one thing that I haven't mentioned this whole time is that for all of these visas, including the green card, you always have to bring a passport picture that has to fit American passport requirements, which is not the same as German passport requirements. So like the format is different. It's a square format, like ratio
I remember that
aspect ratio.
That was an issue for me too when I was getting my German visa, because I needed to get the German requirements. And if you go like in Cincinnati, for example, to a CVS or a Walgreens where people often go to get passport pictures, most of them don't have access or even know what I'm talking about when I say I need something to fit the German requirements. So I went and actually went to the CVS right next to the German consulate, and they of course knew because a lot of people go there. But I think it's more difficult in Germany to find someone that meets the American requirements.
Yeah, I don't actually know because I didn't go to a photographer. I know that they have a photo booth inside the consulate, so if you want to do it last minute, but that's kind of risky because then you're already there for the interview and you still have to, what if it's broken that day? But I know they have a photo booth inside the consulate, and then what I always just did was basically I took the picture myself in front of a white background with good lighting. I mean, I've always had a camera, so, and then there's tools online. I think they're even provided by the US government where you can then crop it accordingly, and then you just have to print it. Then I would just like print it at one of the drugstores in Germany, DM, where you have like a print station. So that's how I always did it, in case anyone's wondering. But that's also, that's like a, such a dumb requirement too, because like saying that you struggled with it too, this shouldn't be something that, you know, is an obstacle for people. It's just a photo.
Yeah.
Like, it's like they should be able to just crop it accordingly to their standards.
But I was so impressed by the big German, like the machine that they have to pop out the picture. I don't know if you've seen that, but like, I showed, you show up with, I don't know, normally when you get, at least from like DM here, you'll get six headshots of the picture. And then they have like a big hole punch that cuts it out perfectly.
Yeah, no, I do know what you mean.
I haven't seen that before until I went to the German consulate.
I think that's pretty much the story. I know that I definitely didn't mention all the details, but I think I mentioned enough. It was probably very confusing. Because even in my head, that's confusing. But to summarize it, I went from J1 exchange student visa to B1 tourist visa to do volunteering, aka an unpaid internship, to F1 student visa to get my master's at an American university, to green card, which was awesome because the green card also then finally allowed me to do whatever I want work-wise. Because like, just like for you, when you switched your employer, it like messed with your immigration status. You can't just be unemployed in the US. If you're unemployed, you're going to lose your visa and you're going to have to go back home. But you can't just also be self-employed on most of these visas, because most of them are directly connected to your role as a university student or your role as an employee. So you can't just be like, oh, you know what, I'm starting a side business.
Yeah, that's how it is in Germany too.
Yeah, same with the work requirements too, what we said earlier. As a student, the student visas, you can only work on campus, or I was only allowed to find a job in the field of my studies, which that one really frustrated me because I was like, well, I have a bachelor's in communications. Can I not find something in communications? And they were like, no, your degree in the US is German studies, and that has to be directly related to that. So like your job title basically has to have something German in it. And it was like, cool, that's that's very easy.
Yeah, real, real niche.
I applied for an elementary school teacher job at Fairview.
Yeah, I remember Fairview? That. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Fairview.
At the language school, the German language school here in Cincinnati. I didn't get the job. I didn't want the job really either, but it seemed like one of the only options I had. Oh, I didn't have any like teaching. I mean, I had some teaching experience in college. I was teaching college students, but it's very different than elementary school.
Oh, yeah. Very different. Very different.
Yeah. I didn't have a certificate or anything like that. I was actually surprised they still let me interview.
Yeah. Crazy. Crazy. But no, that's been a very... umfangreich, comprehensive overview of, I would say, our immigration stories.
Yeah.
We'll see what continues to happen as life continues. Permanent residency, hopefully, for me here soon. Who knows? Maybe an American passport for you in the next couple
of
years.
At some point. Yeah, I would be eligible in August of 2024.
Yeah, it would be crazy.
We'll see. Maybe. But thank you guys so much for listening through all of this. I know it was... very much information. And
yes, but that was also our goal. I mean, this isn't like a fun stories necessarily, but we just wanted to share this, the struggles of immigrating, but also to show you that it's possible. Like,
yes,
even though it is difficult, it's possible. And
yeah, and I feel like I had a lot of obstacles, and I still made it here.
And not only made it, but you thrived. Like, I mean, I saw you through, I saw you throughout the process too. And yes, there were lots of obstacles, yeah. But you're still able to enjoy your life while you're going through them.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But I was very lucky too. Just winning the green card lottery.
Yeah,
that was huge. Very lucky too. Because there's a lot of people who play that year by year by year and never win. And I played it once and I won. And I was like, oh, wow. Okay, yeah. I guess destiny is trying to tell me something here.
Yeah. But I guess with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up this very long episode.
Yes, I think we made up for the skipped episode now.
Yes, I think so too. But thank you all for listening. And I won't go through all of the things that you can follow us at unless, Feli, you want to add anything.
No, they already know where to follow us.
You know where to follow us, and we will talk to you again soon.
Yeah, we'll see when. Either that's what like I was gonna in say. A week or in 2 weeks.
That's why I just said soon.
Surprise.
I was like, well, I'm not ready to commit to that yet.
All right, see you and hear you next time, guys. Bye.
Until then.